Welcome to the first Bike Shed podcast.
Boom.
We need a theme tune. Who's going to do that?
Not that one.
No. Someone's already got that.
You still owe me speakers in my van from when you broke them trying to sing.
Yeah, all right.
So, with all of this Bike Shed LA chat and you guys going off on trips and jollies and us planning our 10th show, we're just having a bit of a recap on how the hell this crazy journey all started. What you guys did initially before I turned up, and then Gareth, who we've got here, our head of retail, you know, I turned up a little bit after him. So we're going to try and get across to people who are listening, both of them, how this all started, what it involved. So I think, Dutch, you should go first and tell us how you turned from KTM forum geek into this motorcycle empire.
Boom. Okay, well, really it was about me getting a bit bored with the press and the shows. Biking was really getting geeky, and also I think I was going to kill myself as I was getting into the whole world of KTM geekness.
Oh, I thought you meant you were just sad.
No, I was like, our marriage wasn't that fucking bad.
Well, I don't know. I was out on my bike. I was just realizing that everything about bikes was about going faster and faster and faster. Everything was about performance, and it was getting a bit boring and a bit dangerous and a bit kind of pointless. It was all the magazines ever talked about was another 3 brake horsepower minus another 2 kilograms and a new paint job. I wasn't really reading the magazines anymore. And whenever I went out for rides with my mates, mostly on Super Duke R's, because for some reason, bikers at that point, you could only go for a ride with a bloke who had exactly the same bike as you. I don't know what that was all about, but that seemed to be the law if you were a biker. We all went out on our matching black and orange Super Dukes to Finching Field on a Sunday morning up the B184 and the 1056. And then we were really pleased that no one died. And I'd come back in time for Sunday lunch, because all of us were only allowed out from really early doors till Sunday lunch, because that's how it worked.
How does that work?
I know, Vicky was different. I was lucky.
That was his other missus.
Yeah. But it was that whole thing of, you know, we're still alive, no one died. There was just too much jeopardy and too much crap and too much geekiness. So it was actually Vicky who did come on the rides with us and was on her wicked Buell, who decided to sort of steer me away, because I was following Bike Exif and all this kind of cafe racer custom stuff that was appearing on social media, and I thought it was pretty cool. And I think we'd just seen the Ducati Sport Classic 1000 in Tron, which just looked epic. This really old school bike there to promote a kind of high-tech film all about bikes that don't exist in a virtual world. And Vicky bought me a Sport Classic 1000 for my birthday.
That's mighty generous.
I mean, that's all right, isn't it?
That's a gift.
That's a keeper.
It's certainly a keeper, because I got to keep it.
So yeah.
There is method to my madness, guys. I'm not crazy.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It seems to now be your bike. How did that happen? So,
but what sort of year are we talking?
We're talking about 2010.
Right.
So, yeah, it was a while ago.
And is this about the same time as there's a Barry meeting Barry, and he's on his cool Triumph, he's at Visor Down.
Yeah.
You guys are dressed up as Power Rangers in Soho something.
Well, that was a moment, one of the many epiphanies along the way. So there was a crowd of us, and you know, me and Vicky both worked in media. I was in television, she was in television, and we went out with all our mates on bikes, and Vicky pointed out to me that the only people that I liked in media were people who rode bikes, and all of the rest of them were, bleep it out, Dan, all the rest of them were cunts. And I thought that was a fair point, that it all took bikers for, you know, it took bikes to bring us all together. And we used to ride to Bar Italia all the time, because I'd rather go to a non-bike place as a biker. I don't really want to go to a sausage factory with bikers in it talking about bikes and kicking tires. And me and Vicky turned up to Bar Italia one day. I was on my Super Duke in orange and black, in head-to-toe matching black Dainese with an AGV lid on with a black visor on it. And Vicky was on a black Buell, all in black, with her XR 1100 showy. And we looked like Power Rangers from another world who'd been beamed in from the future to shoot people with ray guns. And our mate Barry turned up. He was the creative director at Visor Down magazine. And he turned up on a white Bonneville with his girlfriend on the back in a pair of jeans, Timberland boots, and a fag hanging out of his mouth and an open face helmet. And he looked cool, and we looked like dicks. And that was a bit of a moment for me that I realised that...
Well, you obviously looked all right, Mick.
Well, no, clearly I looked good, and I was on a Buell and not a black and orange scary machine. But I think, to cut a long story short, the bike that I got Dutch, which I obviously got for myself, was the changing point. And Dutch was spending way too much time on these KTM forums and porn. And I was like, we need to change this up a bit. I said, why don't you stop wasting your time commenting on forums and actually write a blog about your experience and all the shit that you're ranting about all the time? So I think the Sport Classic was that point where it changed from trying to go as fast as you can to actually getting involved in the lifestyle element of biking and also the machines in a non-technical way. And so I got in the bike and said, start a blog. And he started a blog. And the bike shed wasn't always named the bike shed. I'm not going to tell you what it was named, but it wasn't at the beginning named that.
Really, it was the story of me getting this bike. Because the first time I got the bike and I thought, well, this will be a really nice, relaxed ride. It's an old air-cooled Ducati and it's only got 90 brake horsepower and it won't be very fast. And but I decided to take it on a track day to Brands Hatch because we used to do track days all the time. And I thought, I won't take the Super Duke, I'll take the Sport Classic. And then I was 2 seconds a lap faster compared to my 136 measured rear wheel brake horsepower on my Super Duke R. I was actually quicker round the track on my Sport Classic. And it was more fun and it was more engaging. And everybody was like, what the hell is that bike? What are you riding? You know, what did you just go past me on? And I was way more confident on that bike. But also it was the journey of personalising it. Because it wasn't so high-tech and so complicated, you could change the shocks and you could play about with it. And, you know, we dropped the yokes down the forks to get a bit more of a kind of sharper turn in and started changing the seat and the position of the clip-ons and wanted to change the colour of it because it was just this impregnated Ducati plastic that wasn't really a paint job. And then that became the story of customising the bike and riding the bike and getting away from this whole sports performance thing.
And as part of that, we used to meet up. So once we kind of found our new rides, if you like, we used to meet up at the pub, of all places, to have a drink with other bikers. And we were all sat round the table. There was about 12 of us sat round the table. It's the... The Flask.
It was the Lancer
So the big idea happened at the Flask. So we're all sat around the table and everyone's going, who's going to go to the bike show? And we're all like, and I'm the first one to go, no, it's, you know, full of lycra and bad coffee and really crap lights and not really interesting unless you're out to buy a new bike and you want to sit on it and see if you can put your feet on the ground. And then we just kind of sat around and said, well, what about if we did our own show? And it was that Carlsberg moment where, you know, it was that point where we were like, well, actually, it'd have really good coffee. And if you weren't a rider, you'd still really love it. And there'd be cocktails and nice lighting and no ropes around bikes. And, you know, no girls in Lycra trying to take your database, you know, take your information for the database. And so a week later, we met at the pub again and had our shandies. And Dutch said, I've booked a space.
You didn't have shandy.
I was on my bike and I don't drink and ride.
Yeah,
so that's a good public notice right there. Public notice, everybody. Do not drink and ride. So that's kind of how it happened. And the next thing, the blog, everybody was sharing their stories for Dutch to write about their shed builds. And it kind of grew a following from that. And we did an event.
Can you remember your first blog post?
I think my first blog post was, it might have been the second one, but the one I remember most was the one sort of trying to detail the entire history of the Ducati Sport Classic 1000. That had how it came about and who did it. And I think it was called Retro Before Its Time. And that was the first post of note. And it became quite defining for people on the Ducati Sport Classic forums.
You're pretty geeky about those, aren't you?
It was super geeky. I transferred my Super Duke geekiness into Sport Classic geekiness before I realised it was about people, not bikes.
And then you just took a punt and you booked some space around the corner on, what's the name of the road? Rivington Street.
It was just off that.
Just off Rivington
Street. Bateman Row.
Bateman Row.
Yeah.
So you booked the space. Was that Ranks's place?
Yeah, it was Ranks's place, Shoreditch Studios. And it was that whole sort of idea of trade fairs are crap. None of us bikers who spend all our time and money on bikes want to go to the big UK bike shows. Why not? It's because they're crap. And we tried to make the opposite of a trade fair. It was supposed to be the people's show, the punters' show.
And that was, what, May 2013?
Yeah, we planned it before Christmas in 2012, and we decided to book it for the beginning of the season. It was like, well, when does the season begin? The season begins in May. So the first show was May 2013.
And, gee, did you go to that one?
I did, yeah. I volunteered at that one.
How did you know these guys before the show even started?
I bumped into Dutch on Holloway Road in 2012, and I was a sort of fan of all the custom bike blogs.
You weren't a KTM geek, were you?
I was not a KTM geek. I was into classic bikes, and through Classic Bike magazine, I discovered Sideburn through Gary Inman's piece in Classic Bike, and then I discovered Bike Exif, and it was like a tumble of awesomeness in terms of bikes that totally changed everything I was looking at. And then I started reading the Full Tilt blog along with all the other blogs, and I'd read on the Bike Shed one morning about Dutch's new Z1000, his Kawasaki. And then I was riding into work, and the Z1000 that I just read about that morning pulled up next to me, and I was like, hang on, I read about that bike on the Bike Shed this morning. He was like, oh, I'm Dutch, it's my bike. And I was like, yeah, I know every detail of it. And so we rode a few sets of traffic lights together and chatted about, and he said, oh, we're doing a show, you should come. And I said, I'll help. And then I left a message on the blog post, and I think it wasn't a long time before the show, it was maybe a month or so before the show. And then met Dutch and Vicky at the pub for a drink, and then I turned up at the show as a volunteer. And
who was it back then? It was Barry, you,
yeah,
Ben Redgrove, yeah,
famous NASA photographer.
It was Adam from Untitled,
yeah,
Tim and Kev from Spirit of the 70s.
It wasn't big, was it?
It wasn't a big group of people.
Small group.
Was Loic involved then?
No, that was later, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was a bit of a blur.
I remember arriving as a volunteer and not really knowing anyone and kind of thinking, oh, this is weird, who volunteers for something? And it was great. Everyone was really like, oh yeah, take this amazing bike and put it over there, and it kind of snowballed.
Hugo Eccles, he was another one, and Ian Hartfield. Yeah, they were there right from the beginning. You had a really cool ratty old Ducati 750 SS,
yeah,
with the one with the half bikini fairing thing on it.
It was kind of held
covered in stickers. Literally held together with stickers.
It was a fantastic bike. I loved it. But that was the beginning for me. And then I just kind of kept volunteering at the shows and saw them get bigger and better from that first one on. Because the second show came.
That was October.
Yeah.
So I went to the first one on a date. I took her there on a date.
Smooth.
It was great until she got abducted by the lady from Davida, who kept trying to make her buy helmets. I'm on the date here, not you. Get your hands off. I then bumped into Hank, who was with his girlfriend. I said, how did you manage to persuade your girlfriend to come to a bike show in an arch in Shoreditch? She said, oh, I didn't say it was a bike show, I said it was an art exhibition. And she was like, yeah, I'm bang up for that. And she was very happy with it.
It was an art exhibition.
Yep,
definitely.
I didn't know you guys then, but I left my engineering job at a race team out in the countryside, contacted Adam from Untitled and said, I've seen your video on YouTube or wherever, can I come and check out your workshop? I'm moving back to London. So a Honda that I'd built, I then rode down to Adam's. He said, that's a really nice bike. His wife pulled up and said, that's a really nice bike, you should speak to Dutch about putting it in the show. I said, okay, it can't be a show bike, that's so ridiculous. So I then contacted Dutch, he fobbed me off to you, and then I met you guys at the first Distinguished Gentleman's Ride.
Yep,
and then I said the same as G. I said, well, I'll help volunteer for the show. So I turned up with my show bike.
All fresh face.
Fresh face, and none of us had... Well, I had a little stubble.
Yeah, you had a bit of facial hair going on.
And then met you guys there, and there's a nice picture of us lot sitting...
Exactly.
...in a little bit across the road.
We were having a deep and meaningful conversation.
We were.
I think I actually told you my life story at that point. And that's really unusual for me to talk.
What?
Was it Prosecco for you?
During a show.
Gareth and I had to go away and have a beer. We'd only just met.
That was my ploy to get you involved long term. It's like, I'll give you a bit of heart and then you'll come on board and give me lots of sweat and tears and blood, and the rest is kind of history.
met it was Gareth Roberts that day as well. So.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And Gareth Roberts.
He was the first person I ever met. Actually, I wheeled my bike in, and I think I was the second person there. Gareth wheeled his in. I tried to engage in a conversation and thought, come on, these bike gang people aren't very friendly, are they?
No, that's just Gareth's imposition. He's just a bit grumpy.
But that second show was when all the sort of original guys kind of all started performing and getting together all the time, wasn't it? So it was Tim and Steve and Ali and Gareth and us lot. And
then that turned into every Wednesday meeting at your house, dinner around the kitchen table, then sit on the sofas, nine of us, to plan shows and taking over.
I tell you what, that was the hardest part. Working till 2 a.m. after I've just done a full day's work was easy, but trying to deal with your meal requirements, cooking for like 12 boys every Wednesday night, a vegan, a vegetarian, a chicken lover, a beef lover, I'm like, so that was quite a challenge.
Yeah, well, that seemed to be great.
They were fantastic. No, we started
on takeaways, and then Vicky started her turkey shepherd's pie made with sweet potato.
Until Gareth decided he was a vegetarian or whatever he was that day.
Mad, lovely greens with like honey on them. They were amazing. I never ate greens before then.
See, look at that. I converted my boys to Brussels. those were good fun, those nights.
And it was during those nights we decided to get our balls out and lady balls and book the tobacco dock space instead of just the little arch here.
Yep. I mean, we were getting to a point, I think, when we did our second show. The first show, obviously, we lost money and it was a free event. The second show, we took...
Fiverr on the door.
Which kind of washed its own face. And then it was kind of getting to a point where actually... The blog was getting such a great following and people were loving what we were doing, so it was right, okay, we need to properly go big or go home and create. And if you imagine, you know, at Tobacco Docks now we have the whole entire top space. You know, we had, you know, a big space, but it was a few rooms. It was not even half of the venue when we first started doing the show.
It seemed huge at the time.
And yeah, exactly, it kind of blew us away. And I think that's when we realised as well that this was now a grown-up thing and becoming more of a business. And I think the best thing that we ever did, and I'm so proud really of Dutch of doing this, is when we said to the key team, thank you for volunteering, and this is a business, and there's a little bit of chunk of the pie. Because I think rewarding people for what they gave us, you know, every Wednesday night you guys came round. You know, we didn't finish till 2 o'clock in the morning. There was meetings in between. There was work on top of jobs. And it was just a way of saying thank you. And actually, that's what this building is built on. Each brick is built on somebody's hard work and sweat and devotion. And being able to say, here's a little piece of the business,
sweat
to
equity,
say,
it's like a pyramid.
It was sweat equity, literally.
Sweat equity. Well,
literally.
So winding the clock back slightly, what did we all give up to do this? I left a job. Anyway.
I gave up money and a social life and my family.
But you were working. What were you working in at the time?
I moved from TV into publishing, and I was the group commercial director for HarperCollins. So I had three teams delivering, I don't know, 30 million a year, a PA. I worked 4 days a week. I got paid a shitload, and I gave that up.
Dutch?
I was working for an advertising agency looking after big brands like British Airways, and I was also on a 4-day week getting paid for a 5-day week as a creative director on nice bonuses and all the rest of it, and it was a very easy life. But what it did do is it gave me one free day a week just to do bike shed work, which was brilliant.
Yeah, but it wasn't just on the one day, was it? Because I remember I used to come to your office and your computer screen didn't face anyone else's, so you could do stuff.
Yes, that's very true. I would say I wrote one story every day while I was in that job.
Yeah. Or when you were at home.
Or shared or did stuff. Oh, when I was at home, yeah. I was.
Our marriage suffered for about 3 years.
I was buried in a keyboard just documenting stuff or trying to do the shows. I was very lucky. But,
And gee, what were you doing before?
I was an actor.
What sort of actor are we talking about? Adult actor?
Yeah, I was kind of.
Really? Star!
I was doing. At the time we met, I was doing a play in the West End, and then after that, I was touring with theatre companies, predominantly in America, and that was when I started helping out with some blog posts.
We came to see you in Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, you did, didn't
you? Mate, that boy can dance.
Yeah,
even playing
jazz
the dad.
Hands.
yeah.
and dancing. And yes. and I tell you what, I'll never forget the site when we were building this place here. Sorry to go off the curb. But, and we were hiding all the shit because Triumph were coming in, and we were pretending that we were going to be ready when we didn't have a clue that we were going to be ready for the Triumph launch.
You know they had a contingency for
yeah,
that.
I know. They booked a second venue. Second place, I heard that later on. That was a wise decision. And we were chucking everything into the cupboards, and then something got chucked in the back of the cupboard. And I swear to God, Gareth did a standing splits, put one leg over this mound of stuff,
and kind of
tippy-toed doing the splits into this space to pull something that was really important for the meeting out. And I was literally blown away. I've never seen a man do a standing split and bend his leg and navigate paint and sand and a mountain of crap to pick something out. So it changed my whole view about him.
Useful life skill.
100% in this world.
And we used to do a bit of writing together, didn't we? So yeah. I started helping Dutch out and lighten the load on writing the blog posts. And we took them pretty seriously, didn't we?
They would be
1,500 words long, and we would go, I don't know, two paragraphs of an introduction about a CB550 that... Which now you look at and think, oh, it's got a loop tail, a bent seat.
I remember us searching for hours to try and identify random old tanks that had been put on Brat builds, trying to work out what year it come from, which dirt bike.
So I think what are we into now? Something like 1,400 posts on the website?
It's insane. It's a really big number.
I think what are we now? We're 2019. So my first blog post was in February 2014 or 15. It's coming up the anniversary of my fourth or fifth year of
doing. That's mental, isn't it?
Yeah.
I loved your first post. That was what got you the job. It was brilliant. You wrote your story about your
actually
own
no,
bike.
That, yeah, that's a lie. The first blog post, the proper one I did was for Moto Sumisura. Frank's second name. Probably Sumisura, isn't it? But yeah, the first one was my little Honda.
That was your Honda. That was your story of your Honda. And normally what would happen is someone would write a story for me, and then I'd have to re-edit it.
Exactly.
And they'd send me gash photos, and I'd have to Photoshop the hell out of them and reframe them and put them in a sensible order. And you wrote a story, and it was so enjoyable. I thought, I'm not editing that. That stays as it is. That story goes out as written by the builder.
And that was the bike you ragged around this building.
Yeah, when we got
our keys. We first got our keys. It's like, it's so funny how you're not allowed to sell that bike.
No,
it's so funny how that story kind of carries on. And in fact, you were also the first paid employee for the bike shed.
Before us.
Yeah. Well, that kind of went tits up, didn't it? Because I was working somewhere as a temporary thing, and I was thinking, I had all offers and opportunities to go and do something grown up and career wise, and I thought, I think there could be something in this, but I don't know what it is. And then it got to the point where I couldn't do the blog posts anymore before and after work. But I had a job where I was helping a guy dig the foundations for his new mega shop in West London. So I used to back the tipper truck in and then sit there and write a paragraph while he was loading the tipper truck. I then drive to O'Donovan's waste recycling plant, sit and wait in the queue writing another paragraph, tip it in, and then carry on. It just got too much. So I said to Dutch, right, if I can do a day a week for you, can you afford it? And he said, oh, no, I don't think I can. And he came back and he said, okay, I'm just going to do it, day a week. And then we did that for a while, and there was just too much volume of work. And then said, well, you know, I've got other opportunities. It's a take it or leave it. And you said, okay, let's have a meeting. Sat down. Let's go with this. And then it was that same week you said, I can just about afford this. And then your job situation changed. And then all of a sudden, like, shit, I've just given you a job. Now I need one.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
It was in the same bloody week.
It all changed at the same time. I mean, hiring you actually saved our marriage, because I didn't see Dutch. Every night he'd come home till 12, 1 o'clock in the morning writing stories.
Can I get a pay rise?
So, you just can get my forever thankfulness.
Can I get a bike? He got a bike.
If
I've saved your marriage and your sex life, can I get a bike?
No, he should be buying you a bike.
Can I have a bike?
Well, you were the one complaining about the sex life. You should buy him the bike.
Yeah, but I'm still fucking complaining. What's changed?
No, it's different. Now I'm just old and tired.
Yeah.
It's completely different.
This is about our personal stuff. Right?
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, don't do
then
it.
Then might be able to edit that.
Yeah.
So then, whose crazy idea was it to do a bike shed show in Paris?
Oh, that was a great story. So we're in Biarritz, and
At Wheels and Waves.
Wheels and Waves. And we are with some crazy Frenchmen who are riding around with, like, rolling a cigarette.
No, he wasn't rolling a cigarette. Oh. There's this whole story where you think he was rolling a cigarette while he was riding.
It was so cool.
No, he's not that cool. He was on Google Maps because he was lost. And you thought, oh, he's a Frenchman. He must know his way through the Pyrenees. And he was on Google Maps trying to find
him. He was doing that. I thought he was rolling a cigarette. Anyway, he's super cool. Loic.
Yeah.
We love Loic. And
he did have a girl on the back sitting backwards taking photos while he was riding one-handed.
And no one was wearing socks.
No one was wearing socks.
I was wearing socks. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, but you're not French. I meant no one as in the cool French.
Yeah, no French people were wearing socks.
This is how the show came about. So we've been to Wheels and Waves. We've done whatever crazy stuff we've done in the daytime. We went back to someone. In fact, Loic and the boys had rented this apartment.
No, we rented a villa.
No, it was theirs.
Was it theirs?
Yeah, because they had a hot tub and we couldn't stretch to that. So we jump in the hot tub and we're all having beers and we were like, oh, what's next? And Loic was like, you must do that.
Because of the Moto Heroes magazine article.
Oh, yeah.
So Moto Heroes did an article and the headline was London Calling.
Was this when we did the photo? We were on the front cover.
Exactly. Yeah, so they'd been to our show and they'd photographed us, and then they wrote this huge article about how amazing the London show was and why wasn't there anything like it in France.
So we basically, in a hot tub, Loic said, I am French, I will help you.
From Marseille.
Well, Marseille and Notting Hill, darling. He's a hairdresser in his spare time and he builds bikes.
In his spare time, he's got a very successful salon.
No. Well, yeah. Oh. But in his spare time, he builds bikes in the basement of the salon. Then he has to take them apart to get them up the tiny stairs and rebuild them upstairs so he can ride them on the road. That's another story. So Loic is just in this hot tub. We're all kind of French and lovely. And he says, you should do it in Paris and I will help you. And we went, okay, and we clinked glasses. And then 3 weeks later, we pretty much booked a venue. And that was the Carreau du Temple, which is a stunning venue and made of wood. So it was terrifying. Fuel, wood, stains, oil, bike. But and that was how we did the Paris show. It was Loic's fault.
I remember totally messing up because we went out for a recce and we had to get a really early train out of St Pancras on the Eurostar. And I thought, right, this is quite a big thing. I was still a relatively new employee. I must get myself there in plenty of time. There was a tube strike, a bus strike, a traffic problem heading into town. Uber wasn't really a thing back then, and I was getting on buses, hitting the next traffic jam, getting off the bus, then sprinting, getting on the next bus, and did that all the way to St Pancras. But I didn't want to make out to you that I made a mess of it, so I said, oh, don't worry, Dutch, I'm just a little bit delayed, I'll just get the next train out. And he's like, dude, these train tickets are like 250 quid each. Like, it's fine. And I got to the desk and I just said to the woman, whatever it takes, I must get on the very next train because your one had just left. And I thought, you know, I put a mental limit on this, 400 quid. If it costs more than that, I'm not going to do it. And she just looked at me, saw the panic in my eyes, gave me a free ticket.
Wow.
I jumped on the train.
Damn.
And I got to, not Charles de Gaulle, what's the train station?
Guard.
Got there. And then, you know, you usually have the guy standing there saying, would you like a moto taxi? And you're like, bugger off, mate. I'm busy. I can look after myself. I saw the guy. I said, yes, take me to them. And they had them all standing there on these Honda Pan-Europeans. I said, which of you is the fastest rider? And they said, this guy here. I said, right, get me to this address as fast as you can. Here's the money. Put his helmet on. Race to the cafe. And just as there was the clink of your coffee cups being put down by the waiter,
I turned up,
stepped off the Pan-European as if it was all planned.
No big deal. We were like, he's coming in his own time.
It's fine.
Yeah.
He'll get there.
Under his own steam.
That first Paris show was a comedy of kind of errors and hard work and fun and games.
It was amateur hour in the best possible sense, wasn't it? Because we didn't know what we were doing.
Exactly.
And just had a go.
And the red tape and everything that's crazy about Paris. But there were some funny stories, you know, people getting ill, food poisoning, lost.
The hotel nearly killed us.
Also, the big thing was cash. We took revenue, but I hadn't worked out how to bank the cash. And I got there and they told me I couldn't bank it. So we all had to split the cash and the coins in our luggage on the way back and go through the security check. And we had like bags of money and it was really heavy. And they were all like looking at us very strange because we looked like cash runners or
money runners.
Would you remember
there was a security breach alert and they shut Garden Law down? And we thought, shit, it's because we've all got like $5,000 of change. And it was some old boy who had taken a bit of explosive from the Somme somewhere and put it in his luggage and couldn't put it through the scanner. Do you remember?
Like a hand grenade. It was a hand grenade.
It was a hand grenade. What an idiot.
Poor old boy.
Those were the funny times.
That was mental. Yeah. That was when Gunn got his hair cut by Frankie. Finally got himself, got rid of that D'Artagnan look.
Yeah.
And then that night he pulled.
Oh,
and Frankie
God.
Took
in
full
Paris,
credit.
He did.
Yep.
He took full credit.
I don't remember that.
You probably weren't there, mate.
Well, I just remember Fabio and the nice lady selling ice
cream. Zip and flip. You ever want to know what zip and flip means, just come and have a chat with me. I'll happily explain.
The praline girl. The girl selling praline.
Yeah, but she might know who she is, so don't say that.
But she turned up the next year with a pram.
I know. I'm going to lay off. Fabio's got a baby. No! But yeah,
it was a huge success.
Yeah, it was a massive success. And
that
I think
Paris show was beautiful.
Yeah. It was stunning. The venue was lovely. Apparently the mayor loved us then. And, you know, everybody was really excited about the show. It was hard. It was hard to get support. But I think not from the scene. I mean, the builders and everyone were amazing. And the brands were really supportive. But it was, I think they had never anticipated or saw anything like that at that scale. And it was a massive learning curve for us all. But you know, we were slick and smooth. And we did that show a month before the London show. So we were all pretty broken afterwards.
That was insane.
And then we went straight into the London show. So there was definitely
April in Paris, May in London. That was
exactly.
It was such a stupid idea. We said we'd never do it again.
Yeah, and then we did it
until the next year.
we did it again. Yeah.
And the mayor guy and the owner of the Cœur du Temps then suddenly changed his mind and said, and it was a new owner. They said, oh, we don't want bikes.
Well, it was actually a mayor. The mayor kind of stepped in and said that they were banning bikes within the Perifique at certain times, and that's why we couldn't have that space. So then we went and had the big, crazy caterpillar space by the river, which, you know, was a good space and had its challenges. But I think that whole kind of us on tour in Paris was, you know, it was a great experience. Just the in-between bits and the chaos and the lorries breaking down and the food poisoning and people lying in dark rooms amongst the storage and stepping over Gunn trying to, you know, restock the T-shirts because Gunn had, I don't know what Gunn had done, but something clearly,
he was, bad, wasn't he?
He was in a really bad way.
He
and
Gareth's commander of the French language, that's always impressive.
Yeah. That always worked well. But there was some very good fun times from that. It was a good,
and that was when you really demonstrated your shopkeep skills. Because every time we did a show, you were the charming actor who was going to sell all of our stuff to people with your dulcet tones and your charm of the ladies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
What happened? Did you get married? Oh, that was it. Sorry, Sorcha.
Yeah, the shop was. It's amazing how that kind of grew, wasn't it, the shop? It started such a small thing, and then it kind of kept taking a bigger piece of the show, and then it was kind of just...
You put your hand up for that early doors, didn't you? When we were all trying to divvy up what we would do. I can do that. Yeah. I will do that.
Yeah.
That was a good thing for you to kind
the
of take over.
The thing I miss is starting work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, well, you know, those were the days.
Otherwise, most mornings off to sort of...
Laze around.
...stuff and ride motorbikes.
Do you remember the Pompierre at the first Paris show coming to you just before we were about to shut down for the Friday night before we opened on Saturday and said, no, you can't open the show because these bikes have got fuel in.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to go around 170-something bikes with the Pompierre and either organise to have the fuel taken out or lock wire all of the caps shut.
Oh, it was a nightmare.
And we got... what's his chops? The handsome guy from Tin Can Customs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, the good-looking one, Alex. Yeah.
So the one with the really good-looking sister.
That's it. So I said to him...
I don't remember him at all.
If you organise all of this, you can fill up your silly American bike hauler outside with free fuel. And it's had a congregation of people pushing their bikes out to him.
God,
and they were just pumping all of the fuel out of their bikes into his truck.
We'd placed... Not only did we... Had we
the show
placed,
was set.
The show was set. We placed all the bikes. We're like, this is really easy. We finished at midnight. We can go and have a little beer or something like that, or a glass of fizz for me. And then the guy, he was like the fire warden at Pompierre or whatever.
Comes around and just mean something else.
And like literally every single bike had to be taken outside the venue, emptied of fuel, and it was just
We had some disasters with building this venue. We had our the ducting disaster. We've had other disasters that we had that were all near misses. Mate,
there's been loads of disasters.
You died twice.
I spent not the last show, the show before.
2016, you spent half of it in an ambulance.
I spent half of it in an ambulance, and hopefully no one actually noticed that I was gone for half
of the show.
Well,
there was a lot less swearing.
There was loads less swearing, but yeah,
Vicky goes into anaphylactic shock if she touches a fish, sees a fish, eats a fish, or anything fish-related.
Yeah, and Tobacco Doc's food, who they forced me to use their food, gave me vegetarian food that was covered in fish jizz.
Nice.
So that was lovely. So I nearly died. We did one of our early shows. We had somebody got taken ill. Actually, lovely.
Will's dad
had a heart attack at our show. That was kind of, that was literally heart stopping. But thankfully, he's good and well. What else has happened? There's been loads of random stuff. Ali got the shit in a really bad way. And to the point where he was the only one allowed to drive the massive lorry in Paris. So I basically, we were staying in this hotel that had a square in front of it where you're not supposed to park anything. And I made Ali park the massive lorry outside the hotel and told the hotel that they'd gave him food poisoning, so they have to look after our truck all night, and that it wasn't moving. And do you know what? To give them credit, they put a security guard outside to look after it. But Ali, I literally had to put Ali to bed. He was in a right... Yeah, I know, it wasn't the best
thing. He's a bit
thing.
Of a wet fish, though, isn't he, sometimes?
He was in a right old state, so that was kind of funny. Oh, and then... Gareth, when you had the massive fallout when we were filling the truck in Paris... Was it you and Ali, or you? Yeah. No, it was you and Gareth Roberts. No, I had to fight with Gareth Roberts over the radios.
It was all good. I mean, it was a high tension scenario. We all worked it out.
What we've learned, I think, is we've got over that kind of, if someone's stressed and they shout at you, it's not personal. But what we haven't learned is that we can never hire enough humpers to the work.
Moving plinths.
Every year I upgrade the amount of humpers for the shows. And because the shows get bigger, we never quite estimate it. So we
do. You just don't listen to us. Every year we say, let's have this many, and you say, I'm going to trim the budget.
There at 1 o'clock in the morning lifting 50 sofas or, you know, 500 plinths.
We all started going to the gym again. Everyone's like, oh, you're getting fit for summer. It's like, no, I'm getting fit for the show.
Oh, no, I really do. I start a training program leading up to the show.
You have to.
Seriously.
It's a killer. But, you know, that's the point. And what my favourite bit, and just kind of I'll shut up after this, but like this year when we finished the show, we got back to the bike shed in Shoreditch about midnight. Our lovely team kept the kitchen open and served us all a massive roast dinner. And we stayed here till 5-6 o'clock in the morning. The sun came up, talking and laughing. We were absolutely exhausted, but we were talking, laughing about the show and sharing stories. And for me, that moment, and I never want to stop doing that moment, because during the show,
can
you
we
can't
do it just a bit earlier than 5 in the morning.
No.
I was knackered.
Yeah, but, that's the time we got here till like nearly 3.
No, it was earlier than that. Yeah, it was about midnight. It was midnight, 1 o'clock.
No, it was midnight, 1 o'clock that the humpers buggered off.
No,
and it was then till 3 when we were humping.
Back before then, you're just remembering the pain. But the big thing for me is the pain is always going to be there. But what's lovely when you have that moment of you get together and you have a few drinks and you laugh, the pain's not the last thing you remember. You remember something heroic that we've just pulled off. And you remember the teamwork and the good feeling. And for me, that is what the bike shed is about. It's about the people, you know, the volunteers, you know, the hard graft. And the fact that we all give, you know, 1,000,000% to deliver a great show and a great experience. And for me, that is why I get up every morning 7 days a week and get excited about coming to this place or doing LA or doing a show. It's not because I get paid loads of money, because I don't. It's because I work with the most amazing team in the world.
You know, we've now got that officially on record.
Fucking wankers, they're going to use that against me.
Well, got to cut
I didn't
out now,
promise you
swore.
More humpers, though. There you go. No more humpers. You've got to feel the pain to feel the glory. Yeah.
You've got to keep training.
Yeah, keep fit.
More hours in the gym, lifting plates, basically.
Exactly.
Great.
So, yeah.
What about plans going forward? So LA, everyone knows about. What does that actually look like? What does it mean?
Oh, my God, it's huge.
So the building is huge.
Yeah, I mean, we're not supposed to tell people, but, like, no one's going to listen to us anyway, so it's fine.
You know, it's only Dan and James.
Yeah, actually, if you've put up with us for this long, then, yeah, you totally are in for a treat. No, we've got a big space in LA that's soon to be properly announced, but imagine Bike Shed Shoreditch on steroids and some. And we are going to bring the British passion, love vibe that we've created here to LA. And that will be the second one of a journey that's never going to stop.
Well, I think that's the kicker, isn't it? That this has been a journey. Every time I think, oh, it's not really a job. And what was I doing then? And what happened in 2015 and 2014? And you look at pictures of everything. It's just been this weird, meandering, amazing journey that we've all taken and sort of ended up in this place together without any planning to do so.
Because I think we've always been doing exactly the same thing. And that's why it works. You can grow it. You know, because, you know, people talk about, you know, at what point do things in this scene sell out, or when's it no longer cool or authentic? But from day one, we've just done the same thing. We've wanted to display our love of motorcycles, whether they're customized or otherwise. We just love bikes, but we certainly love the creativity around engineering, the community behind people who ride, and the journeys that bikes take you on, whether that's a journey around a track or whether it's taking you from A to B. And then around that, we've always wrapped storytelling and hospitality, and we've just kept on doing that. And whether it was the show or whether it was this space or whether we grow it into the next space, we're doing exactly the same thing as we always did. So it's not like we've had to map out some complicated brand journey. We're just doing more of the same thing. Cool people on cool bikes doing cool things, having a really good time. And I suppose there's a slightly inconvenient thing along the way of, oh, we have to monetize it and turn it into a job. That's the challenge.
Well, that's the great thing is that the why are we doing it is because we would happily just sit and talk about bikes all day and arrange things about riding bikes. We haven't come at it as from an angle of let's see what we can do to monetize a particular market sector, or
100%
let's put on an event to make loads of money. It's come and look at our stuff. It's like when you go to a 5-year-old, and you go to another 5-year-old's house, and they say, "Right, brilliant, come and see my toys." We're just a bunch of older people
exactly
doing
that.
The same stuff.
And there's only two ways you do something like this. You either are already very rich, or you win the lottery, or your dad's got loads of money that you inherit, and then you do something epic and you do it on your own terms. Or you try and do something epic on your own terms and then try and turn it into a business that'll actually make enough money to sustain you.
Yeah.
And that just means there's a little bit more of an art involved in that complicated business bit. But ultimately, we're doing exactly the same thing as we would if we'd just been given a whole chunk of money by somebody rich.
But also, it's an art, but it's not a compromise. And I think that's... I mean, I don't want to talk about bikes forever. That doesn't interest me. You two can sit in the room, or you three can sit in the room. I just sit there and go, no, look at that oil filter. That doesn't really interest me. But actually, what does interest me is making people's... I know, right? I'm just literally, I'll ride it. I don't need to talk about it all the time, but I'll ride it. But the thing that really gets me is actually the fact that our mission is to make everybody's day great who walks in here. And that, for me, gets my go. And also... for non-bikers, gets me going.
Yeah.
That's it. Not that one. You didn't want to hear me.
No, I like your wrong metaphor.
But
more interesting.
But that's the thing. It's like, that's what excites me about the bike shed, because, you know, yes, I've been riding since I was a kid, but it's about the community aspect. It's about inviting people into your home. It's about being nice. You don't have to be too cool for school. You don't need to know everything about a bike. You don't have to be the motorcycle gurus. You're just somebody who enjoys that space and enjoys the people around it. So that, for me, and the people that enjoy that. So for that, for me, is the key thing, is creating an inclusive environment. And all this oh, you know, it's getting too big and you're, you know, you're losing the corners. Everybody has their own call. Who's to say you're cooler than me?
Well,
frankly,
the internet says.
Good answer.
And now you've sort of led it on to bikes. What we haven't mentioned is what we all ride, what we've all built. So, Dutch, what have you got at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I do seem to be a little bit stuck in the world of Triumphs. Really, because I just I love the Thruxton engine.
Yeah.
And so I've had this Thruxton project that we've now called the Hoxton that turned into, first of all, I made it more of a cafe racer and put bikini fairing on it and took it around Linden Hill and went as fast as I could and wanted to make it faster and more performance orientated, but in a sort of retro looking way. And then I missed my T100 Roadster and wanted to bring it back to that. So the new iteration of that is a stupidly large pair of tyres on 16-inch rims on a Thruxton with handlebars and gone back to a bench seat, because actually I really like bikes that have that riding attitude and something I can chuck around London city streets.
It's because you're old and you can't use clip-ons.
I can't use clip-ons. They're so uncomfortable. And I've also got a street scrambler, which is my daily ride. But I need to get more bikes back into my fold. And well, Vicky seems to own my two Ducatis. I don't know how that happened.
These Sport Classics.
Yeah. Yeah. And then suddenly they belong to Vicky.
Well, one of them's mine now, isn't it? Didn't you promise me a bike earlier? What was your first bike, Dutch?
But first ever.
First ever.
Suzuki TS125X.
How old were you?
I was 17. And I thought it was... It looked like an RM250 to me. So I thought that was proper. It was the same colours and everything, and that for me was just wicked. And I liked it so much that when I passed my test, I bought a TS250X.
Oh.
And I liked that one so much that when they brought out a blue one, I had a yellow one and a blue one.
So you were a geek from day one.
I was an idiot from day one in terms of buying the new bike before I'd sold the old one. Then I had two bikes the same.
Yeah, you've not changed one bit.
So I was an idiot.
Exactly.
And they were exactly the same, and then I had to sell one of them and nobody wanted to buy it, so I had two bikes the same in different colours for ages.
What about you, G? What
first bike? I had a Yamaha DT50 MX.
Nice.
Oh,
the MX.
Oh, white one.
I know it's blue.
Black, blue one.
Blue and yellow. It's a great thing. Yeah. But
what are you tooling around on now?
I've got an Africa Twin now. I feel a bit like an imposter because I'm
grown up.
Dad bike.
Yeah,
dad bike.
But it's an amazing thing. It's black. It's cool. It's sexy. You can go anywhere on it. And I'd had a series of bikes that broke down all the time.
Yeah.
I was pushing them a lot and I thought I need something that will do everything. And at some point I'll have time for the projects. The Kajivas still lingering in the garage.
You two and your Kajivas, what is it that you really wonderful. Like about really old discontinued trellis frame
exactly.
bikes that are going to break
Why
down?
Why do you think I bought him an RAC pickup thing for his bloody birthday?
There is nothing wrong with Kajivas. Yeah, everyone that rides a Ducati, they're technically riding a Kajiva between a certain point in time.
I mean, they used to have... Yeah, Kajivas are wonderful. Mine doesn't work, but when it does, that'll be the problem.
Factoid.
Yeah. In the meantime, the Africa Twin's doing everything.
Well, I've had over 100 bikes, and that Kajiva is one of the most reliable I've ever had.
How come it wasn't reliable when Gareth rode it?
I mean, it kind of wasn't that bad.
He got a different one.
Yeah. Wasn't that bad. But it's funny, because the whole Africa Twin, while being at the bike shed thing, might seem slightly odd, but it's just about... the community and people riding bikes. And it's a broad church now. It's somewhere for people to come on bikes, isn't it? So it doesn't have to be a brat or a scrambler. It can be anything.
I think the thing is,
we all share.
If wife was happy with you spending all your time in the garage and you didn't have white goods in the garage and other crap from your building projects for the house in
there
the
would
garage,
be more
you would have. Yeah, and if you weren't. You hadn't spent the last 4 years working day and night here to set this retail operation up, you would have been tinkering and fiddling with something. You'd have a project.
Breaking something.
Moving nicely on to how many bikes have you actually got now, Ross?
I'd have to do a tally thing, but it's sort of circa 13.
So out of those 13 bikes that you own,
yes,
how many of them actually work?
What's work? What do you mean
well,
by work?
Okay. Let's define working as the engine... propels the wheels, you can get on them and go places, and let's also add on them being in some way road legal or insured,
MLT.
So you can ride somewhere.
One scooter, right?
I have got a scooter. I've got a Triumph Street Twin, that's legal.
Oh, there you
Nigel's
go.
Looking
there you
after
go.
That.
That's
there
legal.
You
I
go.
Just bought an Aprilia Philippe Starck 6.5 that has a number plate on the back. Everything else is sort of dirt. Oh yes, the Honda, my original show bike, 1966 Honda Scrambler.
So we're saying that 4 works. Out of 13.
Beautiful. They all have potential.
Yeah, the Kajiva Elephant, that works, and that has a number plate on the back.
MacGyver potential.
But I think the other one's not. Ah, no, hang on, WR250. Taxed, insured, it's nearly new, so it doesn't need an MOT. It's got
wheels
on it and some lights. Okay,
that's not bad ratio compared to normal.
So it's all right.
It's doing good. At least none of them are here.
It's true.
Thank you.
Usually they are in bits, not working in one of the arches.
3 years it's taken.
A frame in a cupboard somewhere.
Yeah, mate, I'm telling you, under my desk.
And Queen Vic, what's your tally?
Oh, I don't know how many bikes I've
apart from
had.
The ones that I actually own, really, but you seem to think you own.
My first bike was a little Honda 50.
Off-roady one.
It was red off-road with little knobblies on it, and I got that when I was 5. My first road bike was the Husky, the SMR 400.
Oh, that was nice.
Which was a beast. And then I got the Buell, and then I've had the Ducati, and I've got 2 Honda Dominators.
They are exactly the same.
But one's got a tank.
One's less rusty than the other.
And one's got feathers on it that you handmade. So I actually can't get rid of that bike because it's sentimental. And the Sport Classic, Ducati Sport Classic, and then obviously the Paul Smart, which is my rainy day fund. And that's it, really.
You got a Ducati Scrambler coming.
Apparently
full throttle.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise. I've lined up the bits to go on it and lined up the builder. So
as long as it's loud.
It will be loud.
But yeah, all these things, I don't get excited until they're in my
possession. That's why we haven't bothered telling you about it yet.
So thanks for that. So it's,
we'll just present it to you and then you have to like it.
Okay, cool.
So just to wrap up, it's the impossible question. All four of us around the table, dream bike.
One bike.
You're going to die tomorrow. There's one bike to have a go on before you die. So it's not even about ownership.
Can I not go first? Okay. Well, let me think about it compared to what everybody else says. Gareth, you should go first.
Oh, it's tough.
All right, I'll lessen the blow for you. Dream riding experience. How about that?
Okay.
So bike and
surrounding. Do you know what? Walt Siegel's new adventure bike.
Oh, yeah.
I fancy a go on that. It's not somewhere sexy. Down in South America. Big tour on that. Is it based on a multistrada?
Yes.
It's got a slight whiff of Kajiva about it, hasn't it?
Well, I'm going to have to double check on that.
Yeah.
That would be what I'd go for. Currently, it was different last week.
Right. Things?
Something that's got brakes and starts.
That'd be a first.
Exactly. All my bikes haven't got any brakes. Dream bike or dream... I mean, I need to do some more adventure and dirt stuff in my life. I mean, I do want a sports bike because I'm just a dick, but I don't want to ride it on the road, really. I want to do track stuff.
You're going to die tomorrow, so it's anything dream. Does it have a VR sticker on it?
Oh, of course, mate.
Yeah?
Rossi's.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll take one of Rossi's old track bikes and show him how to ride it.
On which track?
The one with the corkscrew.
Laguna Seca.
Laguna Seca, yeah.
I'm going to do that course this year. It's in America, right?
Yeah.
It's LA.
Yeah.
So, close. There you go. I'm actually going to make my dream come true this year. Yeah. Might not be on Rossi's bike, but I'll stick a sticker on it.
Aim high, we have so far.
Yeah, if you're listening, Rossi or, Yamaha, feel free to share the love.
If I could only have one bike, I would take a KTM 950 Supermoto and I would turn it into a proper sort of roadster bike, but I'd keep all the suspension so you could really ride it off the road and do proper scrambly stuff on it.
Right.
So sort of a bratty, scrambly KTM 950 SM designed machine. That would be the perfect one-off bike for me. Unfortunately, there's nothing quite like it that exists in the universe.
So you're going to have to do your own.
I'd have to make it, but you said dream bike, right?
Yeah,
so
dream bike. Yeah.
That's my dream engine. That would be that.
Nice.
Boom.
Now, I asked the question to buy myself some time, and it hasn't worked. So all I can think of is if I was going to die tomorrow, it would be Kenny Roberts TZ750 around the Springfield Mile. Because every time I've watched that video 20 times, I get goosebumps every time I watch it. And
nice.
I would just hope that I could do a tenth of what he did. Wow. A fifth. No, a fifth is more than a tenth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're like small going amount, for it.
Yeah, yeah, that would be me.
Cool. Oh, now I want a different one to... Anyway.
So I think we've rabbited on for an hour or
seriously,
so. James is
no
going
to
pull the plug on
this.
Our inaugural podcast. And next time we'll be talking about other stuff. Probably bikes, so you can...
If anyone's still with us, wow, thank you.
Can I answer? Yeah, thanks for listening to us. Like...
Yeah, you win a prize.
Yeah, you should win a prize.
Yeah, you
right in,
win a prize.
james@thebikeshed.cc to claim your prize.
There you go.
It'll be a set of ear defenders.
We will test you on it.